Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and today we get to talk to filmmaker Matt K. Turner. Now, let me apologize right up front. You don't get to see the film Reflector, and that's all capitals R-F-L-K-T-R. And actually, the R's are reflections of each other, which, after you see the film, you realize how cool that is. But Matt is saving the release of Reflector because he's a working screenwriter in Los Angeles and is probably pretty close to taking it out there to make it as a feature. So this calling card he made as proof of concept for the feature film Reflector is something he's not letting out to the world yet. But it won a grand jury prize at Film Invasion Los Angeles last year, and it just blows my mind how good it is. I'm actually a really big sci-fi fan, and you see so little sci-fi pulled off well, whether it's from Hollywood or in the indie film circuit. So when I see kick-ass sci-fi, I just want to learn more about it. So strap in and listen to this interview with Matt K. Turner.
I grew up in fairly creative household. My mom was a poet, and she taught creative writing in school, and she's written books. And so, I grew up doing lots of artwork, drawing and poetry and things like that. And I don't know, maybe around elementary school, somewhere in there, junior high, I started making some short films with my parents' video camera, grabbing action figures and blowing them up with firecrackers and doing really bad jump cuts to my friends jumping around and all, you know, really silly stuff, but it was fun. And then, you know, typical childhood stuff, got into skateboarding and things like that and kind of lost the film bug for a while. But when it came time to go to college, it did seem like a logical choice. So I ended up at film school at UC Santa Barbara. And I had, overall a really good experience there. They're definitely strong in theory and history and analysis. Not quite as strong in production at the time. I'm sure that it's improved by now, but at the time it was a smaller production department. We did make films, but it wasn't quite as robust as, you know, I'm sure other schools like USC and UCLA, but, you know, it was a good basis for an education.
Yeah, exactly. And it's very, the film studies program at UCSB is really focused on, like you said, history. And I mean, I think you get a lot out of studying stuff instead of just jumping right into production and learning by making your own mistakes.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there's value in both sides, but it certainly doesn't hurt to, you know, have a deeper understanding of filmmaking over history and also just why people made the choices they made in their films and kind of do your homework. And so when you start making your own films, you have deeper roots. And overall, it was a good experience. I did make a few films while I was there. But it wasn't that I disliked the collaborative process, but I got bit by the music bug. I started DJing in college and started making electronically based music. And I found myself really attracted to the ability to just make a complete work of art by yourself. You didn't need anybody else. If you had a keyboard and some computers and a sampler and you could make something that sounded, you know, like a real piece of music.
You could be a one person composer, producer, everything and see your results.
Yeah, it was exciting. I mean, I made some music. We put it out on vinyl, you know, just pressed it up ourselves and found distribution. And it was just, you know, you could make something totally DIY and get it out there. And people were, you know, buying it and listening to it. And it was really exciting to just have that access and the ability to just create and not need to go through, you know, professors or a studio system. Nobody's giving you notes.
Yeah, and you don't have to beg friends to hold booms and cameras and things.
Exactly. And so,
and that was pre-internet, right? Sort of. So
yeah,
at least pre-Napster. So you getting your music out there on vinyl, I just think a lot of people wouldn't realize that that's really a very cool accomplishment.
Yeah, I mean, it was super DIY. Like I said, I mean, literally went around to record stores in Los Angeles and San Francisco and just walked up to the whoever was in charge and said, hey, you guys want to sell my record? And they would listen to it and they'd say yes or no. And then eventually I got a call from a distributor in New York that had just happened to see it and pick it up. And they asked if I had actually, you know, legitimate distribution, which I didn't. And they decided to pick it up. And so all of a sudden I felt like, oh, I've got, you know, an outlet now. I've got distribution. So if I make more, it's going to be, I won't have to walk around carrying my stack of records at least. And so by the time I graduated from college, I just felt all my energy headed towards music. And so I walked out with my film degree and ended up moving to San Francisco where, you know, I grew up Northern California and spent a lot of time in San Francisco and I had a lot of friends moving up there anyway. And so I moved up to San Francisco and started a record label and put a whole bunch of music equipment on credit cards and basically taught myself how to run a studio, make music, how to, you know, distribute music, how to run a label. And it was small, it was an independent label. And but I was able to license music to labels in UK and New York and to some films. And, you know, it was a real interesting time, very passionate about the art form and DJing around San Francisco. And,
so and that's a great city for the arts too.
Yeah, no, it was an interesting time. It was during, you know, interesting time in San Francisco. Some friends and I had started a kind of a tech company at the time, and this was quite some time ago, and so we experienced the thrill of the first dot-com bust, and so it was kind of crazy. But I eventually started a band, actually, and we were trying to mix electronic music with rock music, and this was quite some time ago before it kind of became normal to do that. And so we thought we were kind of breaking down new barriers. And
I think you were. Excited. You were breaking down
barriers. Well, we were trying at least. And that was the goal. And so we were very excited and thought, you know, if we're going to be a band and a rock band, you know, where do you go? You go to Los Angeles. So we ended up deciding to move to Los Angeles. But we pretty much imploded on impact. Our band broke up almost day one of getting
Was it the stress of moving?
Well, it's kind of a long story, but my lead singer moved 6 months before. Well, actually, I can't remember. Was it 6 months or 3 months? But several months before I could move, I was completing some work in San Francisco, and before I could move, and by the time I got there, he had met someone, and he was going to have a baby, and
there goes the music.
There goes the band. Yeah, he's in Orange County, and I was living in Venice at the time, and he wasn't about to make the daily commute to band practice with from Orange County to Venice with a newborn, and you know, I definitely respected his decision to be a parent, but it did cramp our style a bit not to have a lead singer. So, yeah, that was kind of an interesting point. And that had, you know, that was at the tail end of a 10-year career in music. And so I did pursue music for a little while longer. I liked Venice a lot, and I decided I was just going to stay and see what happens. And but I found myself making less music and writing more, just kind of organically over time. Even while I was making music, I was still writing for myself. I was writing music, but then I was also doing some like interviews and music reviews and articles for like Herb magazine at the time. And when I was in college, I was writing for the paper and things like that.
So, right. So you were almost writing journalistically and essay wise.
Correct. And a little bit of just personal creative writing, but yeah, not showing that to anybody.
But not necessarily screenwriting at that point.
No, no screenwriting. I had never written a screenplay at that point, even in college. I think I did. I wrote one short, you know, I wrote the short, the screenplay for the short that I made, and then one other project. But I never took like an extensive screenwriting course in college. So when I started thinking about screenwriting. It was, you know, it was definitely like a new thing, and it kind of happened organically, where I was hanging out with a friend who was actually a professional screenwriter, and he was living in the canals at the time, and he was very supportive when we talked about films, and he encouraged me to try to, you know, put something down on paper. And so the first thing I ever wrote was The Treatment, and I ended up showing it to him, and it was one of these kind of crazy Hollywood stories where the subject matter of the treatment that I was basing this on was something that he was meeting on at Warner Brothers the next week. And it had to do with this Gumball 3000 rally race. And he was meeting with these Gumball guys, and he was meeting with Warner Brothers to do a similar project to what I just happened to send him. So it was just one of those magic Hollywood moments where I just couldn't believe it. But what made it more interesting was that he liked my idea better than what he was going to pitch. So he just asked if he could pitch my idea, and if they liked it, we would do it together. So of course I said yes. And it was one of these crazy things where the next week I get a call and he says that they want to do it. And I couldn't believe it. And I was questioning why I'd spent 10 years wasting my time doing music when film is this easy, where you could just.
Oh, my God. That's so funny.
Yeah. But of course, it would turn out to be my first kind of real Hollywood lesson in the you know, the hard knock life of Hollywood, where you think something's going to happen, but it's never real until you have the contract in hand. And so that ended up going down in flames on more of, I think, a scheduling basis back then. They wanted it when my friend couldn't do it. He had other projects. And so we ended up not doing that project, but it was a catalyst that made me think, okay, I'm not crazy to try this. And my friend was very encouraging. And so then I decided, you know, to dig in, actually try to write my first screenplay. And similarly to music, where I just jumped in and taught myself how to make music, I just jumped in and taught myself how to write screenplays by, you know, reading screenplays and reading books and just DIY again, just, you know, figure it out. And
although you had that great background from college.
True. Yeah, I wasn't a total, you know, newbie, but it was still kind of like, I remember writing my first screenplay and showing it to my friend Rich, and just being, you know, really nervous, like, can I do this? Is this something I'm actually capable of doing? And, you know, getting that first good feedback was really encouraging. You know, this is a professional working screenwriter with a big house on the canals. Like, you know, I trusted his opinion. And so while that screenplay, you know, didn't go anywhere, it was another, you know, stepping stone to writing the next one. And the next one was another hard lesson where I came close to getting independent financing and shooting in Costa Rica, and then lost the money, you know, in pre-production, and that goes down in flames. But, you know, that you just keep dusting yourself off and keep going. And obviously, you know, the second screenplay you write getting made would be kind of a miracle anyway. But, you know, when you're in the thick of it, you expect everything to work. So
yeah, but it's also really promising that anything happened. You know, the fact that it got close. We both know a lot of screenwriters in L.A. who never had something almost get shot in Costa Rica.
That's true, yeah. And so I would take each of these experiences, you know, look at the value in that, and definitely try to keep plugging away and keep your confidence up. And then the third screenplay I wrote ended up being a Nichols quarter finalist, and it's another kind of Hollywood experience where the woman who made my wedding ring was a jeweler slash actress, as a lot of people are in LA, slash something. And she had done some plays with these guys that she knew that were creating a film company, a production company, and they were looking for, you know, character-driven, contained screenplays. And her husband had actually read the screenplay because he was an aspiring writer as well. And he said, hey, you know, you should send Matt's script to these guys. And so she did. And then I ended up having a meeting with them. And out of, you know, the many, many scripts they were looking at as their first film, they ended up choosing my script, which ended up being called Family Weekend. And it's kind of a, you know, it's indie dramedy about a teenage girl who kidnaps her parents for the weekend to try to, you know, fix their dysfunction. And it was meant to be a very kind of small kind of Sundance movie. And we, you know, went through a 2-year process of 24 drafts and finally shot it in Detroit in 2013 with Matthew Modine and Kristen Chenoweth and Joey King. And, you know, it was a really cool experience. I got to be on set for the duration and did a lot of rewriting on set.
I was going to say, on set, they probably had you rewriting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, day one, we realized that we had to write a new ending. And so, yeah, there was a lot of rewriting. There was, you know, punch up things for Kristen, you know, kind of personalizing some of the jokes and things like that. And so, yeah, it was a really cool crash course on just pressure situations and writing things on the fly. And also, we were shooting in Detroit in the winter. And so it was just like a real different experience. I had written it with like Los Angeles suburbs in my mind.
Right. You're a California guy.
Yeah. But to tell you the truth, the cinematic nature of the snow and that area of Detroit just really added a level of texture that I had never imagined that was really helpful for the film, I think. It was a cool experience. It was a 5-year process. I mean, I was lucky to have it, but it also, you know, took a long time. I fell in love with characters that I would never see again. And overall, it was great. However, I definitely started thinking about television after that, that in conjunction with the fact that I was watching things that I had never seen on TV before in terms of quality level. I'd always been kind of a film snob and I wasn't really into television. And then suddenly there's things like Breaking Bad, it was just amazing. And Sopranos, of course, and
yeah,
shows like that.
Yeah. Very big shift in the quality of TV in the last 10, 15 years, for sure.
Yeah, I would argue. I know there's some diehard film or TV people who think, you know, that I was missing out on a lot of stuff when I was in my film snob days. But I do think that there was a big shift in at least, the quality and then also the audience for television, too. I think over time, it's kind of taken up the mantle of what some areas of film that we're not really pursuing anymore.
Yeah. Well, and especially as a writer, I mean, you were now, you know, Family Weekend made you a professional screenwriter, you know, working in that real system. I always read that film is a director's medium and TV is a writer's medium.
Yeah. Well, now having, you know, been on both sides, I have to agree. The big difference is that in TV, you're a writer-producer. So your role is not just as a writer, you're producing it, you go to set and you are, you know, the representative of your showrunner, and your job is to make sure that the episode is produced, you know, correctly and quality wise and that the words are matter on set. And the director is very important still, but it's not the same role as they are on a film set. And, I was actually lucky on Family Weekend that the director, Benjamin Epps, was very collaborative, and it wasn't a situation where I was just kind of not consulted and just meant to be there in emergencies. I was there for emergencies too, but I was also consulting the director about takes and performances. And so I think that was kind of a unique experience, and you have to have a director who is kind of sure of themselves in a way where they don't feel threatened by the writer. And so I was lucky in that regard. And then, in television, you're just, it's kind of a different ball game. But so what happened is I ended up getting into the ABC Disney program after family weekend, and I ended up staffing on a show called The Family. It's weird having your two credits on IMDb be The Family and Family Weekend.
It makes you sound very Disney.
Yeah, and neither of which are totally like family shows. The Family in particular is a very dark show. But it was a great experience. A really good way to kind of get my feet wet and, decide whether or not this is something I want to pursue, if I want to switch, completely to television. But, what I kind of came out with that experience was that I really respected both mediums, and I decided to pursue both. And so I've always had interest in multiple things, and I wrote a novel kind of in the interim. And so, I just like to check everything out, and I don't feel like...
I'm just curious, what was your novel about?
It's called Genesis. I ended up doing the kind of DIY thing on that as well. I self-published it on Amazon, and it's a science fiction.
I was going to say, was it sci-fi?
Yeah. Sci-fi is kind of what it's kind of my jam. I grew up reading a lot of sci-fi and fantasy novels, and that was always kind of, when I looked at like some of my favorite films, a lot of them were science fiction. And so I realized one day that everything I had written, every feature I'd written, was kind of like, I don't know, it was a little bit premeditated. Like, I thought, this will get made, or this is what people will want. And one day I just realized that I hadn't written anything that was just purely what I wanted to. If I could just, think of anything, what would I write? And so I started from there, and I actually wrote it as a feature first. And I was working with a producer who was well known for converting, for finding a book in galley form and converting it into a multi-sequeled, very famous series that I probably shouldn't name at this point because just what happened with this producer. But anyway, he had experience, adapting novels, and he said, I'd like to get your feature out there, but if it was a novel, it tells a better story. With me, at least, I can say I found it as a novel.
So it's not the most pure inspiration for writing a novel, but I bet you had a good experience adapting it.
No, it was. I have to say, it was. I don't know if I ever would have written a novel had I not approached it from this angle, because it seemed so daunting prior to the experience. But knowing that the story works and having a roadmap and where you can kind of just break down each act and or even scene, and scene kind of becomes a chapter. And so I already knew that when I started out on the path that it would work in terms of the story and the characters. And I knew what a lot of the scenes were, and in a way it was really cathartic, because I was able to write out a lot of the backstory that no one ever knows in a screenplay, because it's on your head or it's on, some Word document. But in the novel, it just became a chapter. I would just say, this is where this guy came from, and this is what his experiences were.
And you can crawl inside their heads and do thoughts without, something like voiceover.
Yeah. It was really fun, and definitely kind of freeing from the confines of screenwriting. But at the same time, it also gave me a new respect for screenwriting, because it's actually very difficult to condense and be so concise. And the brevity of a screenplay is in some ways harder than when you can write whatever you want in a novel. And that's not completely true. I mean, obviously you want to be edited in a novel, but you do have a lot more real estate, I would say. And so they're both completely different forms of writing, but, they have their strengths. And there were definitely parts of the novel where I felt like the denseness or the brevity of the screenplay was almost more effective in certain scenes, because you can just, hit these beats really hard with fewer words. And sometimes that's even more impactful. But then again, you know, when you get into some of the deeper character moments, the novel definitely has its advantages. So anyway, overall, it was just a really cool experience, and I definitely would write another novel at some point in my career, but it's kind of a big time investment. So so now, you know, I'm kind of straddling television and features. I'm currently staffed on a show called Power on Stars, and we're writing the sixth season, and it's been a really great experience, and I'm learning a ton. And then at the same time, I'm actually, the first week I started this job, I sold a pitch to Universal. So I'm writing a feature for Universal that hasn't been announced, so I can't really talk about what it
right.
is.
Right, but you're writing for Power during the day in the writer's room, and then your nights and weekends you have to work on this feature?
Yeah, basically, yeah. It's kind of like Power's my day job, and this feature.
No, I mean, I'm sure they're both great. I was going to ask, I kind of wanted to jump back or sort of bring in Reflector for a second.
Yeah.
And ask, like, did writing the sci-fi novel, returning to your love of sci-fi that way, did that inspire you to do sci-fi for a short?
Yeah, well, the short came about, I have, you know, like I said, I love sci-fi, and I particularly love some of these kind of contained sci-fi films like Ex Machina or Moon. And I had an idea for one that was contained and kind of high concept. And I was in a meeting with an executive at a production company, and we were talking about science fiction and our love of those types of movies. So I just ended up pitching her that idea. And at the end of the pitch, she's like, I love it. You know what? You should make a short. And the moment she said it, I knew she was right. I hadn't thought about it, but you're always with short searching for an idea that, you know, that is definitely, contained, obviously, because you don't have a lot of budget and time typically for a short, and then one that kind of packs a punch in a short amount of time. And I knew that this was a concept that I could kind of capture in, you know, 5 to 10 minutes that wouldn't be the complete film, but it would capture the basic idea of it. So I immediately went and wrote the screenplay for that short, like, you know, that night, I think. And it just came out pretty close to what we ended up shooting. And then it was kind of a process of shooting pre-production and all that. It took almost a year to do it all. But a lot of it was because I was waiting for the actress. I had a particular actress in mind, and she said yes early on, but she, Breida Wohl, who you've seen, she's on a show called Mr. Mercedes. And, so we had to kind of juggle, you know, her schedule with, my DP, Sam Gabe. He's very busy. That's the problem when you work with talented people, is that they have other things going on besides.
Right. But you knew who you wanted on that screen, and you knew who you wanted to shoot it, and you were just patient about it.
Yeah. I mean, Sam was somebody I knew from Venice, and he was a very talented artist of his own, right? And he directs things, and he DPs, and he's just kind of, he wears a lot of hats, but everything he's ever done that I've seen, even from his still photography, has always been just beautiful. And I was confident in the story, I was confident in directing, but I wanted to make sure that the images were, you know, beautiful as well. And that's the part that I have, you know, much less experience. So having Sam involved was something that I wanted from the get-go, because I always knew that he would, you know, have me covered on that regard. So, those were the two main pieces. And then, you know, obviously there's other pieces that are important, but those were the two that kind of dictated our schedule. And so we had to find the right moment. And there was a lot of like, oh, we're going to do it on this day. And then, you know, something would come up for one of them, so we would push. And then I would have to hire a different, you know, camera crew. But I found that every single time we pushed, you know, something would change. We would talk about the script, or we would realize that we wanted to use some of the budget for a different camera, or deciding to have a gaffer there to you know, help with blocking the sun and things like that. So they're just, it kind of evolved. Every time we pushed, it seemed like it was a positive thing in the long run.
Yeah, and I'm just curious, did you, and you already had the location chosen?
Yeah, well, actually, that was another reason we pushed, is because we were going to shoot at a specific location that ended up getting a ton of rain, and so they closed it down because they, you know, it's a salt, it's a, you know, a lake bed that once it gets too much rain, it can get really damaged if people are trampling all over it. So that was another reason we delayed. At one point, I had to go find a private lake bed. And so I eventually found a private lake bed that, they rented out, to commercial shoots and things like that. And so that ended up being another benefit of delaying, because I think the private lake bed was a better location in terms of, the other one was a park, public park, where, you know, it's vast and beautiful, but you could also have some guy drive a motorcycle through your thing at some point.
Right. So, and probably harder to find completely untouched ground, I bet.
Yeah. I mean, it is large and you probably could poke around to find something, but you just, it's not secure. We, you know, finally got our date, and it was a very small, compact crew. And we basically had one day to do it, for budget reasons and also, you know, actress schedule and things like that. And it was, I knew it was going to be tight, but I thought that we could do it if we, you know, used every minute of daylight. And, the plan was to, you know, as you know, it's one actress playing two versions of herself. So the plan was to shoot, all of, you know, Avery won up to lunch and then change costumes to the different, you know, one costume was old and ratty and dirty, and the other one was crisp and new. And so,
yeah, in one, she's clean, and the other, she's got around 42 days of grit on her.
Exactly. Yeah. One's supposed to look like she's been there for a long time. And, so we would switch at lunch and she would play, you know, the other half. And so we did a lot of planning of like, you know, these are the shots we get, you know, get Avery one, and then we will reverse and get Avery two. And so I had a, basically a stand-in that we could do a lot of the over shoulders. We had basically, you know, several costumes, and they would just swap, and where, you know, we would do over the shoulder one and to the other. And you know, the difficulty was that Brita happens to be 6 feet tall, so it's very striking on film, but hard to find a double. But we did find someone who was, you know, really great, that she was game to be out in the desert all day. And so that was the way we kind of, you know, basically, I wanted to shoot it in a way where it, if we had just two separate actors, it would be the same coverage. I didn't want anything to kind of tip people off to the fact that we only have, you know, that we're doubling the one actress. And I knew that there would be specifically three composite shots, and those were planned. And what kind of made that difficult is that you have to basically leave the camera there when you shoot one side of it and then not move it and to shoot the other side of it. So we did that right at lunch. So we shot one half of the composite shot right before lunch. Then she changed outfits. And then after lunch, with the camera exactly in the same position, we shot the other side of the composite.
Right, right. So I know that shot. That's the shot where she's facing, each version of herself is facing each other in profile.
Right.
So she was well fed in between those. So dirty, dirty Avery just ate.
Yeah, yeah. She ate a soggy Subway sandwich during this time. But she, well, that was the main shot. That was like the one that we had to get. And then there's another one where she stabs. Spoiler alert, but
yeah,
they have a confrontation, and so that was the other composite. It's a very quick one, but it's also kind of important. So we had two cameras, and we had one, you know, for the wide and one for the close up, and they both didn't move, and we came back and did both of those shots after lunch. And so, yeah, it was definitely a full day. It was hot in the desert, but we got everything. You know, we got the Sam also is an excellent drone photographer, so we got some really cool drone shots.
Yeah, the drone shots add so much.
Yeah, it opens it up. It kind of brings another kind of level to the filmmaking, and it's just amazing what the quality of footage you can get from a drone now is. It's pretty insane.
Yeah, I mean, and it takes your short. I mean, your short looks so impressive. You also obviously did some composite visual effects too, mm-hmm. to make it feel like another place.
Yeah,
but I think I told you at the Q&A at Film Invasion LA that, you know, your film is studio quality.
Wow, thank you.
You know, and it does. If you told me, yeah, I actually, you know, won the lottery and had an unlimited budget for this, like, it's practically believable, because between the drone and the location and her amazing performance and what you did with digital effects, to the viewer, there's not a single compromise that I can see.
Well, I appreciate that. That's high praise. Yeah, I mean, we definitely shot it on a budget. I mean, it was much more than my wife was excited about, but it certainly wasn't studio level. And, you know, we actually shot on Sony A7s, and they weren't even, I mean, they're 4K, but it's not like we used a Red Dragon, which we were at one point, or an Alexa. I think the look of it is a testament to, you know, Sam and his abilities, and also, you know, obviously we did some post work, and the, you know, the special effects with the extra planets and the smoke and things like that. I was able to call in some favors from some friends, and so that was definitely done at a discount. And also another lesson in patience, where, you know, if you wait for them to have, if you allow them to do it on their own schedule, where they have, you know, less work or something like that, they'll definitely give you a discount rather than I need it right now kind of.
Right. If you'd been one of those people who's like, I want to hit the Sundance deadline and I'm going to crank and hassle people till I get it, you might have ended up with something else.
Yeah, true. Although I did want to make the Sundance deadline.
Everybody needs to make that deadline. That's the deadline.
Yeah. But I had started it enough in advance where that was, although I do remember I was going to have somebody else color it, for free. It was a friend, but then, he had, something else came up. So then I did have to, you know, get a different colorist to make that Sundance deadline, but he did a great job too. Elliot was great.
I mean, was that like sometimes over dinner we have to say to a spouse, so, I need to buy, you know, something for the house, but this was, so I have to pay for a colorist now.
Yeah. I had a lot of those conversations. You know, there was, everything was more expensive than I thought, of course. And then there's all these other things that you didn't think of. And my Excel spreadsheet just kept growing, you know, add a line. And probably the thing I definitely miscalculated was how much you could spend in film festival submissions.
That's a lot. I know people who, it's so funny. Yeah, one of the funny things about that is I actually know someone who made a feature, and they pulled it off, a feature for $6,000, and then he spent $12,000 on the festival circuit.
Right. Yeah, that's not surprising. I mean, it's just part of the process. It just, you know, it's just as, you know, key as hiring your sound guy or coloring your film. You know, it's part that should be in the budget. You just don't think about it. But if you don't submit the festivals, then, you know, nobody sees it. So
yeah, particularly with a short, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, for my purposes, it isn't always intended to be a proof of concept for the feature. So the festivals were not necessarily the end game, but it was something I wanted to do. It's always helpful. And
I'm sure you won your fair share of awards. I know you got a grand jury prize at the one of the festivals I program. So I would assume you're getting people to look at your proof of concept for a feature. It having a bunch of laurels for awards must make a difference.
Yeah, no, it's very helpful when you know, when we go out with it, it will be helpful to say it has won this, 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 and this, and Brita won some awards. And we're actually kind of, you know, sitting on it at the moment. It's just a timing thing. You know, the project I'm doing for Universal is a fairly big tentpole. And I think just, you know, in terms of platforming things, we've decided, my reps and I have decided to push the Reflector feature after this. So,
right. And so, and you're saving the Reflector short. You're not putting it out there until you're ready.
Exactly. Yeah. You never know. I mean, it might be great to have it out there, or it might end up kind of burning it a little bit, in terms of sometimes you want that to be a fresh experience, that, you know, it's brand new. And even though people have seen it in the festivals, it's different than putting it online for the world to see. And so, I think we decided to just keep it under the table, post festivals, until we know what's happening with it. And someday,
right, what's happening with it as a feature, in a way.
As a feature, yes, yeah. Exactly.
Which breaks my heart just a tiny bit, because of course I would love to see it out there, but I can be as patient. I'll be patient. It's funny, you showed a year of patience in pre-production, and you're basically showing excessive patience afterwards too.
Yeah, well, I've definitely learned. I mean, this is, when you get into the business, you definitely have to think long term. And, you know, it takes a long time to get in. And then once you kind of get your foot in, you want to make the right moves to stay in and to make the most out of your momentum. And, you know, I think patience is something that is, can always be helpful in plotting your course. And, you know, I want to be around for a long time, and I want to make a lot of films. And so while I'm very excited to have made the short, I want to make, you know, many more things. And if I have to wait for people to see it for, you know, a year, it's worth it. And actually I'm hoping that we're going to be kind of pursuing the feature version pretty soon here. So.
Oh, that's good news.
Yeah, it might not be too much longer. Directing the short was probably the most fun I've ever had. I ended up doing the music for it as well, and editing it, and so
yeah, actually, that's something I forgot to mention just now. Was I remember telling you at the festival that when I watched it at home, like on a really good sound system, I didn't know about your musical background when I first saw it, but your sound design is remarkable. I think it's probably another thing that adds to the polish of the film.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Thank you. I mean, I found the post on the film was just as rewarding. It was so much fun to edit it. I'd never edited before, and I found the editing to be a lot like making music, actually, electronically. At least it's very sequence-based, and, you know, Premiere is kind of like using some of the old sequencing programs, or Ableton, what I use now for music. And so, the whole process all kind of made sense to me. Like, I don't feel like I had wasted any time in music, but it also is nice to have it all come around, to come back into play in my filmmaking as well. And so, I had always known what kind of music I wanted for it. And, I didn't expect that I would make it myself, but, I decided to give it a try, and so I bought a few pieces of equipment, some new Roland modules, and again, you know, just that whole DIY aspect. I figured I would try it first, and then I just had a blast making the music, and it's, you know, it's kind of easy when you can adjust the music to your editing and vice versa. It's not that it's easy, but it's, you can make changes quicker rather than having to tell someone to do something.
Yeah, definitely. So did making Reflector the short, do you officially have the directing bug? You know, if they told you we'll make the Reflector feature, but we want someone else to helm it, are you directing this no matter what?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, typically I have other feature scripts that I would definitely love to direct, but I would allow somebody else to direct it for sure. You have to make your choices. But this one in particular, I'm pretty set on it. I definitely have the bug. I mean, I've always had the bug, but this was confirmation, basically. I always thought, oh, I would love to direct, and my experiences in film school, I enjoyed it, but it's just, it's different at this point, getting to edit it and doing the music and just having your hands on every aspect of it is so rewarding that I just kind of...
Yeah, and you proved you can make it work. I mean, you proved you're not going to blow it.
So,
I mean,
yeah,
how many times does a writer finally get to direct their own work and you find out, yeah, no, they really need that second pair of eyes, it turns out.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess at the base level, it's confirmation that I can do it. And then hopefully it also was an opportunity for me to learn and, you know, so that next time I would make even better choices and build upon that experience. And, but it's also the feature is, you know, it's one of those ideas that they don't let people have a first time on, you know, just any film. And it's the kind of film that they do let people have a first crack at because it is contained and.
Right. Right. Yeah. The feature doesn't shift to having like 10,000 moving spaceships hitting at each other.
Exactly. And it was written that way. And so if I were to give up the director's chair for this, then I would have to think of a new idea that would be a good first film for my directing.
You know, I forgot to say at the beginning of the podcast that Matt is so busy is a staff writer on the Starz TV series Power that we did that interview over FaceTime. And I don't know if you noticed, but I wasn't using the microphone that I always use. For various reasons, I ended up using the microphone on the Apple earbuds. And what do you know? It's not as good as this podcasting mic. Two apologies in one podcast. Had to apologize that you can't watch Reflector yet, and I had to apologize for the microphone I used. But anyway, I really want to thank Matt for taking the time to do that interview. And I really, really, really hope that you get to see Reflector someday, both the short and, hey, let's hope that we get to see the feature too. Because I can promise you, I haven't read the script for the feature. I should probably ask him if he'd show it to me. But I haven't read the script, but if the short is any indication, it's going to be one of the better sci-fi movies you see. So let's wrap up the business. Go to discoveryindiefilm.com. There you can see a ton of great short films. You can get links to great feature films. You can get a link to the Sherman Oaks Film Festival that's every November. And there's, of course, a link to Film Invasion Los Angeles, where Reflector played. That one's going to be in 2019. It's going to be June 7th, 8th, and 9th. And there's two deadlines left to submit material. So if you're a filmmaker, send your stuff in. And if you're into social media, Discover Indie Film is going to be at DIFWINS on Instagram and Twitter. And there's a Facebook group as well. All right. Thanks for listening. Yeah.